And we're off. Welcome back, Badgers, to a solo Golf Badgers episode today with myself, James Bledge. We've got the actual number one Badger is busy at work doing his author stuff and writing away. So I'm afraid you've just got me this morning for company, but we have got a very, very special guest this morning. With that laughter, some people might have already have guessed who that is. We have Phil Helm in the office this morning.
Morning, Phil. Morning, Chief. How are you?
Good, very good. We'll set the scene. It's Saturday morning. It's 10:30, Saturday the 6th of January. Last night, Phil and his lovely Mrs. Viv came across for dinner with the Bledges and the Struts. Phil drank a considerable amount of red wine.
Actually, it was Viv that said to me, "Do you realise how much red wine you drank?" There was three of you, myself, Strutty, and Mr. Strut, and Mrs. Bledge, and I think we polished off a bottle of red each. I don't normally drink that much. And but it was good company.
Also introduced you to some good Icelandic shots that my Icelandic greenkeeper friends gave me.
There was no taste to that, and that was. It was like something that you find in the bottom of your, you know, the cupboard under your sink. It was like, I don't know whether it was
throat cleaner.
Paint stripper. It was a bit like that, yeah.
I think I've had heartburn ever since Christmas Day, and I think it got rid of my heartburn. I think it had an opposite effect.
Yeah, it took the lining out of your stomach. That's probably why.
I know, exactly. So it was great catching up last night, old friends, especially with the Struts being across from Strutty from Canada. So we tried not to talk too much shop last night, so we could talk it this morning in a podcast. So really lucky to have you on, Phil, someone that I look up to a lot in the industry.
Oh, stop it.
Which I know, let's get these in. But we've been very good friends for years now. We met, I think, on the Toro, I had a Toro Student Greenkeeper of the Year winner under a son, Nick Machen, and my award for that, believe it or not, was to go along to the GIS as his mentor. So I was lucky enough to share an aisle seat with you in the plane across.
Yeah, we did, yeah.
And we hung out in San Antonio there for that time, and we spent a lot of time together, got to know each other, and
there was a lot of alcohol involved in that as well, I think. Yes. So there's a bit of a theme.
There's a theme.
There's a theme going through there. But yeah, that is the first time, isn't it? 2017, I think it might have been. That's the first time we were sort of thrust together. And we have been pals ever since.
Yes, definitely.
We've been pals ever since.
I look to you a lot for management advice, I think. And it's one of the things we're going to cover on here. Phil's an author in his own right now after completing his The Power of People book, of which some people listening to this might have and some people might not, but hopefully after this episode might look to purchase said book.
Thanks for the plug.
Yeah, well, we can do that. That's fine. No, because you put your, it's a life's work that's gone into that. It's something you're very, very passionate about. There's not, I think in greenkeeping, it's always about grass, isn't it? And then we have likes of yourself now, John McLaughlin, who's obviously very kind of well known for his staff management techniques and how important that is, and try to bring that into our industry as opposed to just looking at agronomy all the time. We spend so much time at Harrogate, FTMI, all these initiatives of spending a lot of time learning about how to treat people, how to get the most out of your teams. Because essentially by doing that, that's how you get the most out of your golf course.
Absolutely.
And something that I have worked a lot on my whole career as a course manager, and something that I've still nowhere near mastered. You know, there's a lot to learn in it, and it's the most difficult part of greenkeeping.
I think, totally agree. And I think you also mentioned a word there as well, passion. And we're very, aren't we, as an industry, all the people we know, that we're all passionate about what we do. And also I think there's an awful lot where we say about, you know, the more you learn, the more you realize you don't know. And I certainly that's appertains to me. And I think in a kind of a way, it's a little bit like, you know, our constant fight with POA, you know, the battle of Meadowgrass, and you never want to, you just keep going at it. And I think leadership and trying to understand you know, what makes people tick, and what perhaps can make, you know, how can you get the best out of people in an enjoyable way, is something a bit like the battle against porridge. You never ever master it, mm-hmm. but you keep going with passion, and eventually you'll get somewhere. But I think the thing for me with the we sort of touched on the book thing is that, you know, I did, obviously I've had a career, been a greenkeeper all my life, and we were reminiscing last night with Strutty that, you know, we both went for the Camberley Heath job way back when, and it started from there. And then you move up the ranks, don't you? And you know, you take on bigger challenges, more people, all that sort of stuff. And I think when COVID hit, that I realized that I wanted to do something, like write a book, but I wanted to put all those experiences down on paper, you know. So all the things that I'd kind of, you know, tried to develop or tried to make work in all those golf courses that I worked at, I thought, right, I just want to get this down on paper. And but by doing it, I also was doing a sort of a degree in it as well, and it was therapeutic at a particularly awful time for us all. You know, we were all, you know, on furlough and having to do all sorts of things that we wouldn't normally have to do, and it was therapeutic. But also, what it made me do was it made me research. So I felt it took the leadership stuff to another level. It was like, well, those are all my experiences. But actually now I need to understand and learn where they came from, what are the theories, what are the models, and do an awful lot of homework on that and take it to a deeper level and put that into the book. And like we say, you know, the more you learn, the more you realize you don't know. And through passion, if you like, passion for trying to get the best out of people and create a nice working environment for everybody where they can excel at doing what, you know, what they're passionate about. I think that's what drives me anyway.
And where do you even start writing a book? How do you work out the structure of what the book's going to be, the plan? Did you have anyone help you with that, or was it?
I never in a million years now, somebody would say to me, oh, I tell you what, just pop off and write a book, I would have run for the hills, because it was like, well, so alien to me. Yes, as managers, we all write reports and we write newsletters and we write, you know, we write short documents, don't we, mm-hmm. To the boards or to Greens chairmen or committees and things like that. And a book that's, you know, like 50,000 words, you know, you think, where the heck do you start on that? And I think I stumbled on I didn't think I ever had it in me. So there's a lesson there to say to people, to say, try things. Don't be frightened of something that you might never have done before. Just try it, because actually there might be some good in that and you might succeed. And I think I fell into that with writing a book. And I stumbled on a formula that worked for me in my brain. And it was really like each chapter, of which there were 12, just became I thought of a title, a subject matter for each chapter, which was nice and meaty and very greenkeeper-y, and then planned it in my head as a journey. So yeah, start, a middle, and an end. And how do you, in my brain, how would I describe a particular theory or a particular way of doing something? And mm-hmm. I just started, and I put pen to paper, or rather keyboard to screen.
Well, I think that the thing that's so great about it is the fact that it's relative to greenkeeping, whereas there's loads of management books out there. You can go into whatever Waterstones and buy anything, and it's all kind of probably generic to things like from companies like Coca-Cola or Barclays Bank or whatever.
Absolutely.
But we've actually got a greenkeeper here that's written one for greenkeepers on a subject that we probably struggle at the most, to be honest.
I've
really been very lucky to be on the other end of your training quite a few times now, actually. I think most recently at the pilot event at Bernard's at Bernard Academy, where a lot of these are excerpts from your book, and also I think you've done stuff at FTMI.
Yes.
And you do workshops at Harrogate at BTME.
Yes, yeah.
So these are all fantastic. And so maybe we could discuss a little bit about that as well, your public speaking and stuff.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But we've been very fortunate right back from those early days back in 2017 when we first were on that plane out to San Antonio.
You were talking out in San Antonio.
I was doing workshops. And, well, it started with just doing a sort of a 45-minute presentation based on an experience. So, you know, a day in the life at my role then was at Goodwood, general manager at Goodwood, looking after the sports turf department.
And the Spitfire runway.
And the Spitfire runway.
We should never, ever leave that out, Phil, please.
Absolutely. No, absolutely. So, you know, it started, like most of us, where, you know, we're asked to speak. It's you speak about subject matter that you know. So I just used to get up and I used to speak about a day in the life of leadership at Goodwood and what we do. And then I think it then, now, realizing that, you know, my passion, we go back to that word again, passion is to educate. And I'm not saying that I'm the world's greatest educator, but I enjoy passing on. Mm-hmm. I enjoy now learning about business models and how they fit into our life, as in, I'm saying our as in Greenkeeper life, and making them work. And then explaining that in a very logical, common sense, down to earth, fun way that we as Greenkeepers can understand it.
Because I guess a lot of these excerpts and the chapters in the books are probably they're all experiencing about mistakes and mishaps that you've had with staff over the years and how you
blimey.
Think. You
yeah, and the thing is as well with, and I've learned this as well, and not just me, but you actually do learn more from a mistake than you do from getting it right every single time. Because there are no learning outcomes from that. You know, you can't then reflect and go, now, how would I make that better? Did I say that in the right way? How did that conversation go? How did that meeting go? And usually when you reflect, because we're all humans, we all make slight, I could do that better if I just said it like this, or I could do that better if I prepared a little bit more. So, luckily for me, I've made lots of mistakes in my career, and I've been able to pull on that to be able to then put it right and to explain the pitfalls as well as the right things to do.
And did you take mental notes of these mistakes, or did you actually write them down during your management spells?
I think I had to. I have a very poor memory, so I try to jot them down. Mm-hmm. I try to write them down. I think the important thing was that, and the important thing is that you give yourself, and I never used to do this early on in career, but give yourself the opportunity, the time to take a breath and to reflect. And because we're all usually, as Greenkeepers, we're all flat out trying to
gung-ho.
Cram. Trying to cram, you know, 20 jobs into what really you can only do about 10. But we try.
Mistakes are made. I think this is the whole point. I thought that we were getting the Royal Liverpool job after Royal Cinque-Ports. Great, I've got another bite of the cherry here where I know I'm not going to make the same mistakes again. But what I've did here is I've made a whole range of new mistakes. So
but they're good.
If I ever have another job, I'll hopefully get it right third time.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, but I mean, I'll probably make a whole new range of mistakes then. But
we will.
The difference being, I'm constantly feel like I'm educating myself through things like your workshops because I'm very lucky to go on. But these are going to be available to everyone else in the future going forward.
Yes.
We can talk about another time. But I mean, well, Harrogate this year is a plethora of stuff that people can go on.
Oh, massively, yeah. So, and
are you talking to Harrogate this year?
Yes, I am. Yeah, I chose a controversial subject just to chuck it in there, I think the title's something like "Looking After Number One." Is that the right thing to do? Something like that. In other words, we're taught as leaders, as course managers, head greenkeepers, as leaders of people, we're taught quite rightly that where our job is to support our team and to make sure that everyone else is happy around us, and that we're there to support them to get the job done. Mm-hmm. Okay. So in other words, the emphasis is on, quite rightly as a leader, it's not us, it's about everyone else. It's team. That's what it's about. So the controversial title, if you like, is we should look after number one. We should look after ourselves. So some people will go, well, totally the opposite, isn't it? However, through the course of, I think I've got an hour, is that we go all the way round where I explain that personal resilience for a leader is very, very important. In other words, we have to be in a good place before other people around us, all our teams around us, it gives them a better chance to be in a good place as well. If we have good resilience and we're in a good place, everybody that we influence is also going to be in a good place as well. If we're, in other words, if we turn up to work and we're grumpy and we're moody and we snap at people because something's happened to us personally, the people around us will ultimately feel that, mm-hmm. unless we're very, very good at hiding that. But usually we're not. It usually comes out in some way. So in other words, if we look after ourselves, and there's a whole host of ways of doing that that I'm going to talk about, if we're in a good place, everyone else around us will be in a good place as well. And that is what we want. So it's a little bit of a controversial title, mm-hmm. but in the end, it's like, oh, hopefully, yes, I get that.
And have you done this talk before?
No.
It's a new one.
It's a brand new one, and I'm very fortunate. I'm going to talk about this at Harrogate, and then we're off to Phoenix for the Superintendents Association, and I'm doing one a very similar one there as well. Mm-hmm. The only difference, though, with that one is
you've got a translator.
Yeah, because some of the jokes that you kind of crack, it's like tumbleweed.
Yeah. And you just think, what country I'm talking, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, so, but it's because, isn't it, resilience now is a very big thing. You know, there's a lot of emphasis now, quite rightly, about mental health, mm-hmm. and let's face it, you know, we as particular when you come up the ranks within the greenkeeping industry. It can become lonelier and lonelier, yeah. as you go, can't yeah. it? I know we've all had experiences.
And I think it could be the loneliest job going. You know, a lot of time.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, because you know, it can become that. You know, you're the answer man. Everybody mm-hmm. comes to you for the answer.
And you're not one of the lads. You know,
You're not one of the team. As seen by team, you know, mm-hmm. you lead that team, but I think, yeah, it can become a very lonely place. And so personal resilience, and all those things that, you need to be able, all those little tools that you need to be able to build your personal resilience, it is really important. Mm-hmm. So I've done a lot of research, into that, and picked out some of my own experiences, and then deliver it to greenkeepers, superintendents, mm-hmm. because we all speak the same language, we all have the same problems, we all have the same issues,
there needs to be more on it, because it's such a, there's so many potential trip ups in our industry that can actually get you in a lot of trouble with HR if you're not managing the team properly, and it's stuff that we really, especially guys, girls going into course managers' jobs, they need to really be clued up on it.
Absolutely.
I mean, I've certainly had my fair share of things, as everyone else will have had. And sometimes you don't always have a partner or a presence of a GM or a secretary around you at that point in time where you need to kind of, and that could be from anything from disciplinaries to appraisals to decision making on people's futures, you know. So you're playing with people's lives a lot of times, so you need to get it right, and that's just why it's so important that the right training's out there. So it's great that you're doing that. But what we'll do is I'll get Badger to put a note in the podcast with your book.
You're very kind.
So people can look at that, and also to your talks at Harrogate. So if there's any greenkeepers listening to this that fancy going along, we can. If there's still spaces left,
I would imagine.
It's not a sellout bouncer on the door job.
No, no. I usually go out onto the street and just drag people off the street to come in because there's some spare seats, you know.
Oh, but I was just going to Betty's tea room.
It's like, no, come and listen to this. Yeah.
So that I find it all very interesting, and I've had a lot to do with it. But let's go back a little bit and discuss another thing that's really interesting. It's Goodwood.
Goodwood, yes.
You, when I think before I actually met you, I remember seeing you at a talk, and you had a brilliant video about Goodwood that pretty much covered every single sport and motor sport thing going. You know, so
that's,
we can quickly discuss about this. Yeah, yeah, because a lot of people didn't know anything about Goodwood, you know.
No, absolutely, and you know, I spent an amazing 7.5, nearly 8 years there. And climbed up through the ranks. I started as the course manager over sort of 36 holes, and then very, very quickly, introduced a change of culture, where it was a lot more inclusive, and it started to turn the responsibilities not just for myself as the course manager, but for everybody in the team had a responsibility to make sure we had a great culture, great working environment, and we were all responsible for what we needed to do. And it changed the emphasis from it was just me that had to basically do it, to that it became everybody was brought into the vision and the new culture. And so really quickly I got asked to then become a general manager, but not a general manager like in the golf world of, you know, general manager is usually the person that sits in the clubhouse. I was a general manager of all the sports turf, anything that was grass or that had grass involved. I became.
You had golf, obviously. Was there two courses at Goodwood?
So there was two golf courses. There was the cricket. It's the oldest cricket ground in the country, I believe. Obviously there's the motor circuit where the cars race round, and you say, well, that's tarmac, yes, but everything around it, all the environment around it, all the turf areas around the motor circuit, of course, had to be to a certain standard. When the cars come flying off, as they do sometimes, they can't hit bobbles which will flick them over. So they had to be cut, and they had to be prepared nice and smoothly, you know, with areas to run off, so that because some of these cars were, you know, the retro vintage cars, with hundreds of thousands.
Yes.
And they used to drive, and they literally drive them like they've stolen. They were literally think that car, you know, when you see them all, and there's about, you know, and they divide them up into each, you know, category of engine size or whatever, there'd be 50 cars flying around. And you think on that starting grid, there's got to be like a good few million pounds there. And they literally just would thrash them around. You think, if I had one of those cars, I'd be like, nobody touch it. Don't get anywhere near it. You're too close. You know, I'm just going to polish
it. It's the festival speed, isn't it?
Absolutely.
So if anyone Googles
speed, there's the revival later in the year.
Which is the retro one, isn't it?
That's it. But so all the turf areas around that had to be prepared to a certain standard. And then, of course, inside the track was the Spitfires, the airfield, a grass airfield. And, of course, Goodwood, the history is that during the Second World War, it was one of the airfields that the Spitfires took off for the Battle of Britain. So, I mean, it was...
That was a grass airfield.
The grass airfield. Mm-hmm. So, obviously, we had to keep them as grass airfields. We did an awful lot of work to modernise them with drainage and all that sort of stuff. And, of course, the grasses.
So, if anything needs to be smooth, it's got to be that.
It had to be smooth.
Did you inherit that as a perfect airspace? Was that ever laser graded or...?
So the airfield was always there, and the Spitfires, and there was a little airfield club, if you like, with, you know, where you could go and learn how to fly. So I think it was a half a dozen of those little Cessna type.
Did you ever go up?
I did go up in one once. And I've sat in a Spitfire. I didn't get up to go in a Spitfire, but I sat in one, which is an amazing thing, you know, a few photos and things like that.
But you're probably too tall for them to shut the canopy.
My head would stick out the top, wouldn't it?
Biggles.
So the airfield had to be, we spent, or the estate spent a lot of money regrading and smoothing out the runways, and then introducing drainage, and then reseeding it. So
just ryegrass, strong just as ryegrass,
very
as
very
get,
strong
yeah, yeah.
ryegrass. And even then, you know, those Spitfires, the little aeroplanes that you practice and learn how to fly in. They weigh about, I don't know, about half a ton. When they land, they land like a butterfly.
That's
yeah,
light,
but
half
it
a ton.
Is, yeah, it is, yeah. But a Spitfire weighs about a ton and a half.
Right.
And they land heavy. Mm-hmm. They land fast and heavy. And I remember, I never forget having a, you know, when you have those meetings, you know, committee meetings. Well, I had a meeting. We would have a meeting every so often with the Spitfire pilots, and they would come in all their full green, you know, their full green
yes,
one sort of thing, all yeah. that, you know, with the scarf, you know, flying up, yeah, all that sort of stuff,
flying around.
And, that's it, yeah. And I would say, guys, is there any chance when you land, you land hard? Is there any way you can throttle back and land a bit easier? And you think afterwards when you think, that was a really bizarre meeting I had, but
yeah,
any chance, guys, that you could land a little bit softer and can you tell me, can you stop? Could you ask the pilots to stop anchoring on their brakes as soon as they land? You know, just let it, because what you're doing is you're creating these big skids, skid marks, which become, you know, little ruts.
Yeah, yeah.
Apart from them being dangerous, I mean, you know, to repair them is a nightmare. And they conceded a little bit on the speed, although they said, look, they fly fast. They're Ferrari of the in the air, aren't they? They're Ferrari in the sky. He said, but we can't stop the anchoring, putting on the brakes because if we have a failure with the brake at the end of the runway, we have nowhere to go. We're crashing.
Right.
So we have to test the brake to make sure it works because they're old, aren't they?
Yes,
old planes.
Of course.
We have to test the brake as soon as it lands. So we know that they work, because if they then fail, we have then the entire runway to throttle back up and take off, and then worry about it. Mm-hmm. You know, so sorry, we have to keep
fascinating
this.
Fascinating to have a job where you're looking after. So I mean, the great thing about a course manager's job is the fact that every day is different.
Yes,
but for your job at Goodwood, is the absolute extreme
it was.
Of that, you know, because it's the top end of that, because you're doing so many different things. You must never have been bored, you know.
No, every day was different. You know, we had the events, you mentioned the Festival of Speed and the Revival, and there were members meetings, and there's all sorts of things. There's always a big event going on. And of course, where do those events get put? The tented villages, you'll know that with the Open, is you put it all over the grass. And then when the circus leaves town, it's like carnage. And so my role was also to make sure that all the contractors put it back right.
Yeah.
You know, as you know, like for the Open, you know, when the circus leaves town. So it was fascinating. But so this is the thing that then the beauty of our industry is that, and I liken this to like a motorway.
Mm-hmm.
You and I have always been greenkeepers, and we're in one lane. There are suppliers that we rely on to be able to do our job. They're in another lane, and so on. And people that supply materials and all sorts of things, you know, whether it's sands or top dressings or divot mixes or bunker linings, whatever it is, we're all going in the same direction. We're all on this journey, which is a wonderful industry, you know, the world of golf and sports turf. And I think my time at Goodwood just showed that as long as you're passionate about what you do, it's okay to move lanes, change lanes, because we're all still involved. I feel that I've changed my lane in my career now. And after 40 years of being a greenkeeper, I'm now... because I'm now passionate about other things as well. But here we are talking to each other. We're still in the same industry of sports turf and greenkeeping, but I'm in a different lane.
Well,
to
I
you
think
at
because
the
you've changed lane, you've increased your knowledge set. And here's a question then. So, if you were to go back to being a course
this
manager,
is unscripted though, isn't it? Yeah, this is an unscripted question. Go on.
It's because I don't think I could come up with a question as good as this if I scripted it.
Go on.
If you were to go back to a course manager's position do you think, I mean, how much better would you be now? Do you, you'd obviously hopefully be better at your the management side. However, do you think you could pick up the agronomy side just as fast? Does that stay with you, like riding a bike?
I think so. I think, you know, the fundamentals are still there. A bit like riding a bike, a bit like a golf swing. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm nowhere near as good a golfer as you, but you know.
Anyone listening to this podcast would know that's not right. People, you know, just spilling their tea all over the place.
But my, you know, my father, you know, my dad was a golf pro. So
Bognor Regis?
No, up in Morecambe, my hometown. Yeah, Morecambe, which we've just moved back to.
Yes, yeah. Shout out Tyson Fury.
Aye, absolutely. We go jogging on the promenade. You know, I say, you keep up, Tyson, will you? But anyway, no, we don't. I've never seen him, but he does live in Morecambe. But it is, the agronomy side is yes, I feel that if I were being honest now, I probably know 80% of what is the agronomy side of it, because things are changing every single day, aren't they? Mm-hmm. New products, new ways of doing things, all of that sort of stuff. But the fundamentals...
Weather
change. Oh,
single worst thing that's probably the biggest change for...
Absolutely. And the extremes of all of that and dealing with that. So I think, to answer your question, is... I would pick up the agronomy side of it very quickly. The leadership stuff, if somebody said tomorrow, do you want to come and be a course manager? I'd probably say no, thank you very much, because...
You prefer your new direction now.
I do prefer my new direction. The thing is, because...
That was my next question.
Well, the thing is, it's such a thank... I mean, you know, I've done it for 40 years, mm-hmm. you know, you're nodding, and I know, because... It's a thankless task, and I'm enjoying doing what I'm doing, because I'm passionate about it. But I just end up, like you were saying earlier, when you go to your next job, your next role, mm-hmm. you'll learn some of the things that you've learned along the way, but I'm going to make some completely new mistakes going forward, because we're all humans and that's what we do. Mm-hmm. You know, we are not perfect. We are not, you know, we're not sort of Superman, and no matter what we do, we will rectify some of the things that we, you know, put right what we've done wrong in the past, but we're going to make some whole new ones as well, new mistakes.
Well, I think you've found your niche now, and your kind of final part of your journey before probably retirement, yeah, however many years time.
Oh, that sounds, yeah.
Oh God, that's quite negative to finish the podcast, isn't it? But I think what I'm trying to say is I think you'll really settle into this role now, and this is the job for the rest of your days. Will there be another book on the horizon, do you think, or what's the future for Phil Hill?
Yes, there is. The short answer is yes. I started a new book, and who'd have thought it, you know, international
also
author.
Not scripted.
no
it sounds like it.
No,
is, but like, no, I genuinely didn't know.
Yeah,
that.
No, and I haven't nobody's asked me, oh, are you gonna
scoop.
Do another?
Is this a scoop?
It is a scoop. So I am writing it takes quite a long time, because you have to do a lot of research to mm-hmm. make sure that all the business models that you are there, the meaty parts are there, to make sure that they're relevant to us as greenkeepers, you know, sports turf managers, and also that you reminisce, and you put, like you've said, you go back over your own career and personalise the book to say, mm-hmm. so there's lots of case studies in there. Like the first one is, it's like, oh, I did this, and blimey, don't do that, because this happened to me, and don't fall into the same same problems. But this one, so the first one is the power of people.
Yep.
Because we talked about, as leaders, we want to support and nurture all our team around us. Mm-hmm. So controversially, the second one is called the power of you.
Yep, looking after yourself.
Looking after yourself. Mm-hmm. Because the theory, like we talked about, is the theory is that if we are in a good place, everybody around us that we come into contact with and have relationships with, they're also going to be in a good place as well. Mm. So it's things like, again, 12, same format, 12 chapters, written in a style that is easily read and understandable to us, mm-hmm. As greenkeepers, superintendents, Yeah, it's things like, you know, it's about time management, how to get the best out of your time. It's about how to plan. It's about how to improve our personal resilience, all those sort of things, how to deal with stress, mm-hmm. The pitfalls of looking out for people.
Diet, sleep, private life.
All of that. And I know, and you know, but it is all very, very important. And so, but they're all, when I've thought about what 12 titles, what 12 chapters are really relevant, like, you know, through my career and speaking to other course managers and greenkeepers, what's important to them, I've put that, those are the titles, those mm-hmm. are the 12 topics. And yeah, so it's my own stuff going in there, as well as some real good, solid homework and research. So
that's exciting. Excellent.
Yeah, I think I'm about three chapters in, and it probably took me a year. Maybe hopefully by the end of the year I'll have be able to get it out.
It's an industry first, as far as I know, in Great Britain. I'm not sure if anyone's done anything like that in the States or anywhere else. But
I think, like you said though, is that when you go to Waterstones or the bookshops, is that there are hundreds of great mm-hmm. leadership, motivational books mm-hmm. that, you know, and there are some, I've read a few, and they are fantastic. The one thing that they don't have, though, unfortunately, is they're not authentic to us. You know, a greenkeeper can read those and try maybe to fit the odd model business case type into their working day, whereas the way that the first book and the second one definitely will be, because I've learned from some of the mistakes that I did when I wrote the first one, is it's absolutely authentic to us as greenkeepers.
So I'll be very honest. I have a big problem reading. I read a book.
Yeah.
I'm a very bad studier. I read a page and I forget about it. However, I have read 4 books. I think probably that I can remember. The Alan Partridge autobiography.
Yeah.
Your book I read.
You're
and my
very
wife's
generous.
Also read
Thank
it.
You very much.
I read Gordon Moyer's book.
Yes.
I recently read Richard Pennell's book as well.
Oh.
So Richard he's written a great book about some beautiful golf courses in Britain. I read that as well. So I don't really enjoy reading as much, but I've got a lot of time to sit and listen to stuff. Whether I'm doing work in the office or I'm out in the course. I love podcasts. I love music. Yeah. Is doing like an audiobook something that would probably interest you, especially with that silky accent of yours?
Well, first of all, you know, you've got to... You know, my accent, I'm not so sure. I'd have to, maybe have to employ somebody that can
You
speak
could employ proper. The badger.
Yes.
In fact, this is, Badge, when you're editing this, you'll probably edit this bit out, but this is a call to arms.
Yeah, absolutely.
ASMR voice.
Well, we spoke about this, didn't we? We have spoken in the past, haven't we, about trying to do something like that for the first book. Mm-hmm. And nothing is impossible. My only reservation, if you like, is that to make the book easier to read, mm-hmm. Every page in the book pretty much has
a diagram, a flowchart, a drawing, something
that breaks up page after page after page
it's
of
not,
writing.
It's not like a storybook. It's a bit tech.
Yes. So and it's very colourful mm-hmm. because, you know, so every page or every other page has got a diagram mm-hmm. of a business model, something that then I explain about, well, this is mm-hmm. how it looks and that's how it works. So it's very difficult to get that
reformatted almost. To kind
yeah.
of,
yeah. So it's very difficult to actually, you know, get that over in just words. Mm-hmm. And so that's always been my, but maybe there's a way to get around that. Mm-hmm. I don't know. You have a sort of a more condensed version or something. But I'm a very, you know, there's, another sort of a workshop that I do is about how best do you communicate? And one of the things is that we all learn. We all have different styles of learning. So, like you say, you struggle with just literally sitting and
I learn stuff
reading.
From this. People speaking to me.
Yes. So it's very audio based, mm-hmm. or it could be with lots and lots of diagrams and flip charts mm-hmm. and things. So it's very, and that's very visual based. So when what I've learned one of the things I have learnt is that when I do workshops and do these training sessions that I'm very fortunate now to be starting to do and things, which is so passionate about it, and it's to make it fun, but to get all those different learning styles all mixed in, which means that it caters for a lot of different types of people, but mm-hmm. they are pretty much they're all greenkeepers or people within our industry, but lots of different styles of learning, so that you know the worst thing would be as much as I could stand up there for maybe 2 hours in a workshop, and you've sat in a couple of them, is that I could stand up there for 2 hours and literally just talk, mm-hmm. and nobody would learn anything. It'd be very, very dull. Or I could just stand up there and have a PowerPoint presentation and just keep pointing to the PowerPoint presentation for 2 hours. But and that also would be very dull.
The Bernard one was completely interactive.
Totally, wasn't it? Totally.
Which I thought was really engaging. It was great. And everyone was mixed up. We'd swap tables all the time. I think it was... I mean, we talked a bit about that in the last podcast, actually. And we'll have a special guest on the next one as well. We're going to talk about it a little bit more. So, but I think that is the way forward. Like, it's been kind of more interactive, and because
that's how
death by PowerPoint or people falling asleep. We're not used to being greenkeepers. We're not used to being in classrooms.
No, we're not.
It's hot. It's
absolutely.
It can be dull if people are just talking. So
So it is. It's all that interaction.
You'll get all that with a Phil Helm workshop and a bit of banter.
Lots of banter, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I think that if you make it fun, I it would be dull for me as the person mm-hmm. as the person delivering it. And so to make it fun is the key to it. And I love when I finish having a 2 hour session, even though I'm the one that's sort of leading it, if you like, I learn. Every time I do one of those, I always learn something, and I learn something because I'm in a room mm-hmm. with like-minded people that have a different opinion and a different life experience about whatever we're talking about. So I keep learning every single time I go in there. Hopefully then it's a reciprocal learning experience.
I guess we debated a lot about stuff as well, and a lot of minds were changed, but no, it was I got a lot from it, and I hope it really takes off even more. The second book, fingers crossed, it'll all be good. And as I said, we'll put the notes for Harrogate on this podcast and your book as well. Where can we get your book from, Phil?
So all you have to do is go on to either web page that it's philhelm.com, and you go on there and there's a page that says purchases, and you just go on there, you click on the button. And it's a PayPal thing. You pay. It's something like a tenner, plus a bit of postage, and then it's like a cottage industry. I put it in a zippy bag, and I post it to you, and you get it. You get it within a couple of days.
Signed.
If you want it signed, I'll sign it. Might devalue it though, but it's like So it's very, very simple. Philhelm.com.
And we'll put all that on.
Yeah, thank you very
much.
Mate.
Thanks very much for coming on. It's been a really great little chat, and hope everyone's enjoyed it. We'll see you on the other side.
Thanks, mate. Thank you.
Bye bye.